you know, we were talking about the different characters and everything that wouldn't have existed without Woody. I wonder if Ernie Glick was would be one of those.
Oh, probably not. I mean, you know, again, I don't know how much we ever technically thought about Woody Allen, although the difference was Ernie, you know, a character like Ernie could exist in an independent film, mm-hmm. but you wouldn't tend to see a character like that in a mainstream movie the same way. You know, it was more that, you know, that for a while, at least, you know, you could be short or ethnic looking or whatever and be a leading man in Hollywood. And I think that Woody definitely had something to do with that.
Yeah, you know, the 70s were so forgiving for so much. You know, I always loved just how everything seemed to open up when it came to that. And you could have every stripe. I mean, Donald Sutherland, Elliot Gould, just, you know, all the way from them to, you know, a Paul Newman, who's this traditionally handsome guy, or Steve McQueen. I mean, everybody was out there doing their thing and could play leading men or, you know, schlubby guys or whatever it was. And I love that it was kind of, you know, field day for everyone could come to the party.
Yeah, and I feel like we've kind of gotten away from that a little bit, and I hope it will come. I mean, it comes in cycles, but I feel like I hope we get back to that more. You know, I feel like, you know, leading people in movies nowadays are more the newer generation, with probably with some exceptions, but more of them are feeling more like traditional movie actors in terms of just looks, not necessarily essence, but they're kind of, well, everybody's great looking, you know. I was just talking to my wife about possible casting on a project that I was thinking about, and we were talking about how all the actors that are valuable are all sort of a little too good-looking for the characters that I want, and yet that's who kind of had become stars now again, whereas in the 70s, that really wasn't the case. People were much more quirky than they are now, in terms of just even just visually. And I'm sure that will come and go, but that there was a real time there where, yeah, it opened up, and movie stars didn't have to be. You could be Paul Newman, but you didn't have to be.
Right, yeah. You could be Dustin Hoffman.
Yeah. I mean, but really Dustin Hoffman came to prominence the same time Woody did.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think Woody was as much a part of that as somebody like Dustin Hoffman was. And suddenly we were all going, yeah, you can be sexy and be Jewish and be wear glasses or be nerdy or be this or be a lot of different things. And what sexy was expanded, you know, for a while. Now it feels like maybe it's contracted back down again, but again, things always come in waves.
Yeah. Yeah, you're talking about stars, and the first people that are coming to mind is like, you know, Brad Pitt, Michael Fassbender, Matt Damon.
Right.
Yeah, very traditionally handsome kind of guys.
Yeah, and some of them are wonderful actors. Mm-hmm. I mean, just like Paul Newman was, Paul Newman, I felt like never got, often didn't get the credit he deserved for what a great actor he was because he was so damn amazing looking. But I feel like, I mean, for example, somebody like Bradley Cooper, who I think did a great job in Silver Linings Playbook, but he's a great-looking guy. I mean, he doesn't, to me, look – I mean, they talk about how he used to be way overweight. He used to be – you know, but he's not somebody who – you know, I feel like if that same movie had been made in the 70s, you would have had a Dustin Hoffman in that part, you know, as opposed to somebody who looked quite so much like, wow, you would have been like the most handsome guy in your high school. So I feel like there has been a change back to a more traditional-looking leading man. Although then there's like Seth Rogen, and you kind of go, okay, well, there is hope for the rest of the world.
Right, though too many times he's put into comedies where I'd actually like to see him in a serious role. I mean, I loved seeing Will Ferrell when he did his Stranger Than Fiction. I thought he was one of the few exceptions to, you know, going from anymore. I mean, we used to have, you know, Robin Williams being able to do serious roles, some of those.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't really get a whole lot of comedians going serious and being overly successful with it these days.
Well, I think part of the problem is also just that we're in a more conservative, and I don't mean necessarily politically, but in terms of the business model of Hollywood, it's a very conservative time. Movies cost an enormous amount to make now. They cost an even more enormous amount to market. So the tendency for all except the most independent of independent films is to go with the safe bet and to go with people doing something that you know people will want to see them doing, you know. And it's like, you know, well, we want to see Will Ferrell. You know, people want to see Will Ferrell in a comedy, but we don't know if they want to see him in a drama. And I think so it's very hard to get people to take that risk and say, hey, let's go against the obvious here. It's never been the easiest thing, but I feel like right now it's really ridiculous when you have the conversation with the sort of the money folk, you know, how narrow the first of all, what actors they want and in what roles and in what kind of stories. And it's a very, everybody just, because it costs so much, even if you make a movie at a moderate cost, it's still going to cost, you know, a studio $30, $40, $50 million to put it out there, which means that, you know, movies have to suddenly gross $80, $90, $100 million just to start breaking even, which is just nightmarish. I mean, that's bad for everybody. You know, and it'll change. I mean, it's already changed in that TV, I think, has taken over some of the role of movies in terms of grown-up storytelling and offbeat characters. And, you know, James Gandolfini can be a movie star on TV, you know. But that's really what's happened, is that TV sort of become the place where you go to tell stories that are darker, more complicated, that aren't about always glamorous or, you know, more easily likable people. And movies, with exceptions, but have more generally become a mass audience thing, which is such a complete reversal of how we saw the two medium only 20 or 30 years ago. You know, TV was the vast wasteland and movies were sort of the art. And now I think you could make an argument that that has been not completely, but largely reversed.
No, I totally agree. I mean, Bryan Cranston is almost always second banana, third, fourth, fifth. And then on TV, he's the star of the show.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. On TV, he is, you know, he's as big a star as there is. The list of people that are considered financeable has gotten so short that it's absurd, because it means the same 5, 6, 7 actors and 3 or 4 actresses are being approached with every single project. And if one of them doesn't want to do it, more likely than not, the project doesn't get made.
Right. But then you get those weird instances, too, where it's like the guy who's playing Superman in Man of Steel, or the guy who played Spider-Man in the last Spider-Man movie. I have no idea who these guys are, you know?
Well, the interesting thing is the one place that I've talked to people about that, because I don't know the studio world that well. I mean, part of what's been so interesting about working on the Chris Nolan project is I haven't had that much exposure to that world and how that thinking works. I've worked mostly in independent features. So when there is a certain kind of franchise situation, the movie is the star, not the actor. So that you suddenly can cast a Christian Bale, you know, or an Andrew Garfield as Spider-Man, or because at that level, they're not worried about the star anymore. But then you're dealing with a franchise that's so pre-sold that they can take a chance and then not have to pay the $25 million up front that you would cost to get you whatever Brad Pitt. You know, and in that case, suddenly it makes economic sense. But that's a very specific sort of circumstance where they feel they can take that chance because the franchise is what's selling the tickets, not the actor.
You need to get into that world, Keith. You need to make crazy amounts of money.
This has been a running argument my entire career because I've just never been that driven by like money and things like that, which does not make the people who want to make money by my making money very happy. But I just, you know, I've never needed like a Porsche to be like a happy person. And I'd much rather take a zero off my salary and do something that I enjoy than make a lot of money and hate getting up every morning to go do it.
No, that's the best attitude. I mean, I'd rather see, you know, a Mother Night or a Midnight Clear or, you know, anything that you've done compared to, you know, the next movie that they're making just to keep their hands on franchise rights for like Spider-Man, you know, it's like.
The problem is that those movies, the movies that I was making in the 80s and 90s are now almost impossible to get made. I mean, there are very rare times that they slip through, but that $2 to $10 million range has all but disappeared. I mean, now getting a film made in that range is like winning the lottery. And that's, you know, I'm now actually taking some of my projects and trying to reconfigure them as like well under $1 million because it's the one way that you can get to make, you know, truly independent films. But that financing for things that, you know, Mother Night cost us $5.5 million. And I was just talking to Bob Whitey, who wrote the script and produced it with me. And we were saying, yeah, that movie today, you could never get made for $5.5 million. No one would give you that money because it's just too much marketing costs and other costs. So the only way to make those films is, you know, short of winning the lottery and finding that one Texas billionaire that wants to write a check, the only other way to do it is to do it for $500,000, not $5.5 million. And that can be really challenging, but it's sort of how most of the more interesting little films are getting made. I mean, Beasts of the Southern Wild was made for, you know, nothing. It was under $1 million when they started shooting.
Yeah, it was, and I don't spend a lot of time out there, but I was out in L.A. for something related to my film that I made 15 years ago, and I was at a party, and it was when Michael Bay was trying to do Pearl Harbor. I was happened to talk to him, and he said to me, he goes, my advice to you, stay independent as long as you can. He goes, because once you start working with these guys, talking about the studios, he goes, you never get to do what you want. And I was just like, ouch.
And that's the reality. I mean, that is – and look, and some people are really happy to make that trade. I mean, we all make that trade-off to a certain extent. You know, it's just a question of – I mean, there are people a lot more independent than me. There are people out there who are living in Virginia or Alaska or whatever and making films for $5,000 and, you know, editing it on their home computers and making some amazing things that most of us frustratingly and sadly will never get to see. You know, but sometimes you go to these little film festivals places and you realize – how great some of the work out there is that just will never get distributed, but that is really amazing stuff. And that, so in a way, it's a wonderful time for film because it's become a very democratic medium, and you can make things for next to nothing. But the problem is, most of it will never get seen by almost anybody, and that's what's so tough. So I'm trying to walk this weird middle line that doesn't exist much anymore. Well, it's small, but not so small that, you know, only my friends and family will ever see it. And that's really not around much anymore.
Which is a shame, because you would think with this whole, you know, all the new, and I'm kind of putting new in quotes, distribution models and video on demand and all these kind of crazy things, you know, I know that I'm talking in big time cliches, but it seems like there's been this promise, this carrot held out to so many people to say, no, you can make a small movie because we've democratized the equipment, you know, you can just pick up a camcorder and go out there and do it and get distributed through all these new channels. But it just is, it's such a pipe dream.
Yeah, nobody's found that system yet. I mean, my whole life I've sort of been a short-term cynic and a long-term optimist. I feel like there will be a time that somebody's going to figure out a way to make it work, or things will keep evolving until it does. But I don't see anything right now that seems to be really working. I mean, what is working, again, are these super low-budget films made for super niche markets. I mean, I have friends that have done that have made films for like $50,000 about a subject that they know they can sell, and then sold those videos online to a very targeted audience. But that's a whole other kind of thing, but it's a very limited thing. What people haven't figured out how to do yet is to make a film for $2 or $3 or $4 million and yet make that system work to pay it back. And, you know, it's just not that somebody won't get there, but nobody's found out what that thing is yet.
Right. Hopefully one of these days somebody will break through. I mean, I thought Soderbergh might have been doing it with that kind of releasing it at the theaters and on VOD at the same time, but that just really never
kept. At the end of the day, it didn't really work. Yeah. I mean, that was the problem. I mean, it didn't make money for the people who needed to make, you know. I mean, it still is, at the end of the day, a capitalist business about people who want to make large sums of money. And when at the end of the day they go, yeah, we sort of got most of our money back, but that's it. Those companies don't tend to keep doing it. I mean, those few films that you get to see these days that are in that mid-range, that few million-dollar range, are often made by companies that do it once and then don't do it again, because they do it once and the movie doesn't make the money, and then they don't make another movie, or the next movie they make is a $20 million genre movie.
Yeah, I totally agree. Yeah, it's the rare one that kind of we get to even hear about these days.
Yeah, and there's some great stuff that is made that you don't get to see. I mean, part of why I was so happy that, you know, Beasts of the Southern Wild kind of broke through was I worked with Ben up at Sundance on that project, and I always thought it was an amazing project, but I thought, oh, God, he'll never get to make it, and if he gets to make it, you know, it'll play 3 film festivals, and that'll be the end of it. And that was that one rare one that happens, and there's a couple of them every year that won the lottery and found a way to find its audience. But for everyone like that, there's probably 25 that are remarkable little movies that just, you know, play at whatever, the Cincinnati Film Festival, and that's kind of their life.
Yeah. Well, you know, hopefully, I mean, it's the rare occasion that I get to go to a film festivals anymore, but, you know, I was trying to spread the word whenever I see something that looks good, but who knows? Sometimes it feels like we're just kind of shouting in the dark, but whatever.
Well, but it keeps changing, you know, yeah. And that's the thing. And you know, every once in a while something sneaks through, and like I say, TV is doing some wonderful stuff, and, you know, and you just don't know. I mean, I remember when videotape came out and that was going to be the end of movies, you know, and instead it became the single biggest force for good in terms of independent film, because it financed most of the interesting independent movies of the 80s were financed by videotape, by VHS. So how something's going to end up where, who knows? And, you know, maybe video on demand will click into a way of doing it, or, you know, so it's going to take somebody with a smarter business head than me, but I refuse to believe that won't, there's always going to be a hunger for stories. It's just how do we get them to people and, you know, manage to make them cheap enough that they make sense to make and yet for enough money that you can actually make a living doing it.
Would it be cool if we took that sort of the talk about, you know, look at the state of indie film kind of thing and put that out as a little extra for folks?
Absolutely. Yeah. I don't think I said anything. I mean, the only thing I would ask if is in listening to it, I said anything that you think somebody could take amiss in a personal way. But I don't think I did. I don't think I said anything disparaging about anybody.
No, I don't think I did.
You know, but that's because the only thing I just, again, there's so much meanness in this business. I just don't want to be responsible for like hurting somebody's feelings without realizing it. But as long as there's nothing like that in there.
Well, that whole thing where you were talking about how Ben Affleck really didn't deserve that Oscar nomination. I thought that was a little harsh, but.
Well, you know, what was weird is that I did get a call from the LA Times that morning when the Oscar nominations came out. And I'm not even a big Oscar obsessive person. I'm just not. I just think awards are kind of silly. I mean, you know, and I got a call going, what do you think happened that they snubbed them? And I was like, I had no answer. But I really thought like, well, wait a minute. There are 10 movies now that get nominated for Best Picture and 5 directors. So somebody's going to get snubbed. I mean, I don't know that it was some big conspiracy. I just, you know, 5 people who made movies that got Best Picture nominations aren't going to get Best Director. And I don't know that it means much of anything, but they were very desperate to make it have some tremendous meaning about, you know, people, whether people like Ben Affleck or whether it was like, I don't think anybody thinks about it that much.
Yeah. Did you figure out why they called you? Is there any particular reason?
No, it was really weird. I saw LA Times on my phone and I thought it was somebody calling about my subscription. And I picked up the phone and this woman breathlessly started and was like, you know, what do you think about the, and I'm going, I don't know what the nominations are. I mean, I didn't say that to her because I felt like way too uncool. So I'm desperately trying to quietly Google like Academy Award nominations so I can like have some frame of reference, you know, because I didn't wake up at 6 in the morning to find out who was nominated. And then tried to sort of answer. And then, of course, when I read the quote, it made absolutely no sense at all. And I was like, oh, good. I'm so happy they used that. it's very weird the amount of weight everybody puts in this town on, like, everything that people say and opinions that people have about people. It's just a mean town. I mean, that part of the business I really don't like. There's a lot of cutting, you know, people cutting each other down and all that stuff. That's, you know, I've been kind of thinking for a while putting together a film blog because I take notes on like every movie I see and just what my thoughts and feelings are. But I basically decided I may do it, but I'm only going to put up things about films I'm enthusiastic about, trying to get people to see stuff. And I'm not going to put up anything negative about any movie because it's just too hard to get a movie made. Like if I don't have something nice to say about it, I'm just not going to say anything about it. And I'm not interested in being a critic and tearing somebody down, but I would love to write stuff that would like get people to see something they might have missed otherwise. So, you know, that I think might be something fun to do.
Well, that's kind of what we do. I mean, if we're going to spend time doing our show, we really don't want to spend a whole hour just beating the hell out of something.
No, yeah. It's just too, I mean, there are too few people that deserve it. I mean, there are probably a few people in the business that deserve it, but most people are trying hard to do the best they can. And I feel like, well, you know, nobody deserves to get beat up for that. You know, I mean, I'll criticize a product that's defective or that kills people. But, you know, if you make a movie that doesn't work, I mean, okay, well, the movie doesn't work. You know, I certainly made my share of things that weren't perfect. So I'm not, you know, going to throw stones. But yes. So that said, please feel free to use anything you want. Again, the only thing I'd ask is if there's something you go, well, that could be taken amiss if somebody hears it. That's the only thing I'd ask you to cut around or whatever. But I don't think I said anything bad because I wasn't in an angry or hostile mood. So.
No. Well.
But you know, you accidentally you're chatting with friends, you can say, "Oh, this guy's such a jerk," and you know, because you're kind of just chatting, and he's like, "Oh God, I said that." So I don't think I did anything like that, but you know, and luckily it's like, thank God I don't like think Chris Nolan is a jerk. You know, I mean, it's like, you know, because that would be the kind of thing that would be really easy. Like if you just, you know, you could say something and then realize later, oh, that was a really bad thing to have said. But I'm lucky enough that I'm not working with people that I think are jerky. So, right. You know, because there are some I have in my career. There are people I would really not want to talk about because it would be really hard to say nice things. But mostly I've been very, very lucky to work with kind of wonderful people that I've learned stuff from. So.
You know, if it's any consolation, when I see you in stuff in the past, I always saw you as a decent guy. So, and you've lived up to it tonight. So it's great.
Well, that's nice. Thank you.
Yeah.
Except when he was Arnie, he was kind of a jerk then.
Oh, well, in terms of as an actor, there's nothing more fun than playing a really horrible guy. I mean, give me a vicious, horrible, killer, villain, psychotic to play, and because that all that stuff that you don't know how else to get out in your life, you get out in the role. It's a blast. I mean, that's, you know, every actor loves playing, you know, killers and you know. So I wasn't surprised that Robin Williams jumped to the chance to do 1 hour photo, because, you know, you've always got this dark side that just, you know, it's just wonderful to get that out.
Yeah. Yeah, he does play a really good creep too.
Oh, he's great at it.
Yeah.
He's great at it. You know, and you know, the guy who, and so fascinating, because his whole persona was like the sweetest man in the world. And I met him a few times and he legitimately seems like the nicest guy. But you can just tell there's this excitement at getting to, you know, unveil that dark side that just, you know, it's wonderful. And I understand that.